Which brings us to the next topic. Okay, we are now beginning the third topic in our series on Seaborology. We first dealt with building institutions and how we create social networks. The next, and that, you know, in the context of a shul in particular. Second, we talked about using food to unite. Now I want to deal with a topic that's a little bit more general and abstract, but equally important. And that's the topic of trust. I'm not presenting anything particularly revolutionary here. The sources are going to be more conventional, except for the first page, which has the long paragraphs. But I think the combination of sources that we're going to bring to this theme will, number one, illuminate a rarely considered element of halacha and meta-halacha, overarching halacha. And number two, it's going to bring us, in the end, to a deeper understanding of how we build a trust and a parallel between the trust involved in human relationships and the trust involved in our relationship with Hashem. All of this, probably not in the next 30 minutes, but in this week and then continuing, God willing, into next week. To begin, we talk about the role of trust in building society in general. And I want to look at it from a secular perspective first, with the theory of trust as social capital. I have here two pieces from essays by Francis Fukuyama, who I just love. I can't get enough of it, as you can see, because I filled up a whole side of the page with his writing. But it matters. What he's saying here matters a great deal. In the pieces that I took from him, he talks about the importance of trust in economics. The idea that in a society, economics, the economic functions of society will operate on a much smoother level, on a much more efficient level, if there is trust between the parties. And that trust is social capital. Capital in the sense that it's something that you spend in order to be able to acquire that which you need. Take a look, please, at source number one. And yeah, I really do plan to read through it. He talks about first, maybe I'll summarize as we go along. He talks about first the normal way that we map the global economy. And we talk about how you have the U.S. and NAFTA. You have the European Union. And then you have East Asia. It's a geographic breakup, basically. And as he put it here, at one pole lie Japan and the newly industrialized Asian economies, which have relied heavily on state-centered industrial policies to guide their development. At the other extreme, happens to be geographic also, lies the United States with its commitment to free market liberalism, and Europe is somewhere in between with its extensive social welfare policies. This is in 1995. I don't know if Canada at some point moves to join Europe in this in-between area. But in any case, that's his first view. And he says, that's not the most useful way of understanding global economic geography. Why? Because he says, really, you could divide it up based on industrial structure. Germany, Japan, and the United States were quick to adopt, I'm in his second paragraph there in the first source, were quick to adopt the corporate form of organization as they industrialized. By contrast, the private sectors of France, Italy, and capitalist Chinese societies like Hong Kong, Taiwan, marketized parts of the People's Republic of China, are dominated by smaller, family-owned, family-managed businesses. These are two different poles, two different approaches to society. One that has the large-scale private corporations, and the other that has relatively small companies. And here we get to his point about social capital. He says the reasons for these differences in industrial structure have less to do with level of development. It's not that one society is just more advanced than another, than with a key cultural characteristic. What the sociologist James Coleman has labeled social capital, that is, the component of human capital that allows members of a given society to trust one another and cooperate in the formation of new groups and associations. So that in his view, as he goes on to explain, the U.S. and Japan are similar. They're societies that build on a high level of trust, which allows you to create corporations. That's what allows for the creation of what he calls voluntary associations. And so he says, virtually all economic activity, from running a laundry to building the latest generation microprocessor, is carried out not by individuals, but by organizations that require a high degree of social cooperation. As economists argue, the ability to form organizations depends on institutions like property rights, contracts, and a system of commercial law, but it also depends on a prior sense of moral community. That is an unwritten set of ethical rules or norms that serve as the basis of social trust. Trust can dramatically reduce what economists call transaction costs, costs of negotiation, enforcement, and the like, and makes possible certain efficient forms of economic organization that otherwise would be encumbered by extensive rules, contracts, litigation, and bureaucracy. The statement that he's making here is that the fact that you have trust in a society will help people not only to get along, but will help people to create those institutions that will drive the economy on a much more sophisticated level. If you don't have the trust, no one's going to join into these agencies without incredible amounts of regulation. Yes?
I have a question.
Yes?
So I can see these saying how the laws of the country, but if you're doing ownership or trust in a corporation won't compete with national power, then it might discourage
development
of larger corporations. But I'm not sure I agree that it's a cultural thing, cultural matter. Like, it seems to me that the reason why they may not support corporations in China is because the Chinese would crush them. Because if you find Chinese nationals working corporations elsewhere in the world, which is kind of, you know, and also America,
right,
a lovely country, but you know, this place you can't go the street without getting shot, this sort of line level of
right. Although you won't see the people in those areas creating large organizations and large associations either. In other words, you really have to subdivide effectively. I mean, it's true. And I'm guilty of taking a few paragraphs out of, you know, a serious essay in Foreign Affairs. So I'm not sure that we're really doing justice to what he has to say in terms of the cultural associations. But I agree that generalization carries its risks. And the point about whether the government would actually tolerate it is one that he does address. So that's true. If you take a look at source number two, yes.
Higher the level of trust will lead to the bigger the corporation, because in the society, the higher the level of trust in society, the bigger the organization that could be tolerated.
That's part of it. That's part of it. And also the functions of that organization will be smoother, which will allow the organization to survive. In other words, the activities in which they are going to engage will require the trust of the parties involved, and in fact, to go back to your government point, the trust of society as a whole. Because if society says, what's going on in the U.S. right now in terms of the banks, if society says, we don't trust these organizations, they are too big, then they bring in legislation which effectively crushes the corporation. Because they say, well, we don't trust. And that's the aftermath of the crash. Yeah.
Rules in place,
right.
Culture, the countries that produce those rules.
Right.
So I have no problem with the culture produces the corporation, doesn't produce the corporation.
Right, and there's a certain chicken and egg phenomenon here. It's true, and one does feed into the other, because when the corporation steps outside the lines, then government feels, well, we need to now create the legislation which crushes the corporation. I'm not sure it works the other way. If the corporation plays by the rules, does government become more lax in its legislation? Maybe it does. I don't know. Yeah. And it's an interesting question. In the second piece here from Fukuyama, he talks about how one corporation will aid a second one because of that trust. Because it trusts that ultimately people will play by certain rules and the helper is going to benefit in the end for the help that he provided. That's, you know, he gives you the example of bailing out automakers from the early 70s. Trust is also necessary in other areas. I found a fascinating essay, which I didn't bring here, because at some point you do have to say die, about food controls and the requirement of relying on government or third parties to control your food supply and the role that trust plays in that. Disaster response, obviously, another area where trust is a key component. Religion can help societies build trust among the members of that religion. Emil Durkheim talked about how religion builds trust among its members who share its rituals. When I see somebody on a plane putting on tefillin, right, my reaction is not to call the stewardess. My reaction is, Lanzmann, right? This is a guy I feel comfortable with. When I go to the ball game and I see that somebody brought his matzah because it's Pesach, I say, oh, that's somebody I recognize. And you know what? If I'm in the airport and I have to leave something with someone before I go out to use the washroom, I'm more likely to pick the person who I see has tefillin, who I see has these ritual items. That may be a big mistake, but I'm more likely to do it because I recognize shared rituals, and the shared rituals say this person is, on some level, my kin. Whether it's biological kin or ethical kin or whatever, I assume he's less likely to take advantage of me. That's how we have the Bernie Madoff crisis, right? I assume that he is going to be a friend and he's not going to take advantage of me. The third piece that I brought there from Richard Sosis is fascinating. Because he actually finds the opposite. He finds, not quite the opposite, but almost the opposite. He notes that trust evolves within a religious group when that trust is necessary. So if you have a religious group, like us, that functions as part of a larger society, then the fact that he is a member of the same religion, she is a member of the same religion, we practice similar things, means I can pick them out in a crowd as the people who I will trust. However, if you have a more insular group that doesn't interact in a larger society, it's just among itself, then you know what happens? People don't trust each other just because they're a member of the same religion. Instead, they'll break into subgroups, right? I'll trust you because you eat glatt and I eat glatt, right? Takes us right back to our discussion about food, because everything comes back to food. Instead, we find more narrow means. The trust that develops in a religious group is because they are a minority within a larger society and they need to be able to identify friends. But once the religious group is the society, then they'll look for something more narrow as their definition of a friend. And that's what he found there. You can take a look at source number 3. And he talks about face-to-face reciprocal relations obviating the need for trusting behavior within closed religious communities. Now that I see everybody else and we're all part of the same team, now we need to find a sub-team. That's the core idea. There's a lot more there. I can give you the link online to see the paper. Yeah. Exactly. So, Judaism places a very serious emphasis on this development of trust to cement society, which is what I now want to talk about. The role of trust in building society within Judaism. Within Tanakh, we talk about the importance of use of trust and it's important to society, both from a religious perspective and from a social perspective. Take a look, please, at source number 4, a classic, and it ties into our parasha this week. What more could you ask for? Chizkiah Omar. Chizkiah says, Gadol hu ha-shalom. Peace is great. This is part of a series of sources there, a series of texts there, I should say, that talk about Gadol ha-shalom, how peace is great. But his in particular refers to the Jews camping at Sinai. For with each journey, it was written, and they traveled, and they encamped. Right? Vayachanu, vayisau. Traveling with division and camping with division, meaning it's in the plural. When they came to Sinai, they camped as one. And Israel camped, it says, Vayichan Hashem Yisrael. Vayichan instead of Vayachanu. Hashem said, since Israel hated division and loved peace and became one camp, I will now give them my Torah. In other words, you can receive the Torah once you have unity. Now you're qualified for religious growth. So the trust that binds a society together, and you can debate trust versus peace, and does one cause another, are they identical or not, but the core idea is once a community has that level of trust for each other, now they can merit growth within Torah. Trust has religious value, but it also has social value beyond that. First, let's take a look at the Migdal Babel example, source number 5. Rashi's classic question. Rashi is bothered. Why is it that the generation of the flood is eradicated when all they did primarily was sin against each other? Their sin of Hamas is attacking each other. Whereas the generation of Migdal Babel, the Tower of Babel, seem to be attacking Hashem. There are a couple of different ways to take their story, but Rashi's approach, which is the main approach in the Medrash, is indeed that this is an assault of some kind on God. They don't get destroyed. Why doesn't that warrant destruction? Why do they simply get scattered? So Rashi gives a classic answer. He says, I'm in the middle of the source, But the flood generation were thieves, and had quarrels among themselves, and so they were eliminated. And these, the Tower of Babel crowd, acted with love and friendship among themselves, as the Torah describes, one tongue and many words. We learn that division is hated and peace is great. In other words, they don't get destroyed. Why? Because they liked each other. Because they got along. Just like that. Therefore, they merit survival. So here again, you see the idea that peace has religious value. But it's also social value. And that's right here in Kohelet, the classic quote, source number 6. Two are better than one. Tovim ha-shnayim min ha-echad. For they have good reward for their struggle. Should they fall, one would pick up the other. If one would fall, he would have no second to pick him up. Right? If you stand alone, then you fall alone. If you stand with somebody else, then when you fall, I'll pick you up. Also, if two would lie down, they would be warm. How would one be warmed? A good blanket. And if one would be overcome in an attack, two would stand against him. And the triple corded thread will not quickly break. So the idea is that when you have unity, you also have protection. Whether it's protection for warmth or protection from an attack or protection when somebody falls, the unity has social value. On the flip side, when trust isn't present, it's a disaster. And that's all through Chumash, it's all through Tanakh. Think of the story of Yosef and his brothers. Right? There's a lack of trust. The brothers assume that Yosef is out to get them. Whether they are right or wrong depends on your take on the story. But the brothers believe that Yosef is out to get them, and the result is that they tried first to kill him and then to sell him. The massacre of the city of Nov, right? Nov is a city of Kohanim. David comes to town. David manages to get food and weapons, and then he flees. Doeg, who is close with Shaul, tells Shaul, look what the city of Nov did. They supported David, and he goes in and he wipes them out because he doesn't trust them. They actually had been duped. They didn't know they had been helping a rebel against the king. David told them he was on a mission from Shaul. So they didn't know any better. Shaul doesn't trust them, and the result is death. So all through Tanakh, we're told about the need for trust. And there are four different areas of halacha where trust is the primary motivator. One is going to be the issue of ne'emanut, credibility for keeping community standards. Second is going to be darkei shalom, engaging in activities that build trust within the community. Third is going to be the issue of chashad and maris ayin, avoiding suspicion. And then fourth is the issue of dan lekav zechut, my obligation to judge others favorably. So we're going to go through these four different areas of halacha and show the role that trust plays. And this is one of the points that I wanted to make sure to develop within the Shir, is that it's not as though trust is some amorphous idea within Judaism, but it's actually a driving force within halacha. It affects everything we do through these four different areas. First, the issue of ne'emanut, of credibility, creating a society of people who can trust each other. And I said we would come back to it when we're talking about the food issue and trusting others. Here's where it comes back into play. If you take a look at source number 7, the Rashba, writing in 13th or 14th century, offers an answer to a question he's been asked. He was asked, Sha'alta, he says, you asked me, may we trust a person who is suspected of a transgression regarding prohibitions or not? In other words, somebody comes to me and says, this food is kosher. I happen to know that he doesn't keep Shabbos. Or I happen to know that he shaves with a straight razor. Or whatever it is. So, because I know that he does something that I consider to be an Avera, should I now assume that he's also not serious about Kashrus? Should I worry that maybe he's going to, in fact, lie to me about Kashrus? Because he's going to say to himself, I don't care about Halacha. This guy thinks that Halacha matters. What he doesn't know isn't going to hurt him. Right? Like the story from the ethicist a couple of years back? The New York Times ethicist column. There was a person from New Jersey who wrote in to say that he has in-laws, relatives, I forget the details of the story, who observe kashrut, and they come to them every once in a while for a meal, and there are separate utensils and separate implements that are there just for the use of the kosher observant relatives. Well, once by accident he took a pot or a spoon, whatever it was, and he used it for non-kosher stuff, but he could wash it and put it back and no one's going to know the difference. Is it wrong? Is it unethical? He wants to know. For him to just leave it there and not let anybody know, because after all, it's just his cousin's craziness that he insists on observing kashrut. What his cousin doesn't know won't hurt him. That's the question to put to the ethicist. So, do I have to worry, in fact, that people in general might do this? Do I have to worry that when I have somebody who doesn't observe some area of halacha, I can't trust him at all for other things? That's the question put to the Rashba. So the Rashba says, it depends. He says he is credible regarding other prohibitions. Meaning, if I know that he violates a certain halacha, I can still trust him on other halachos. I can't trust him on that one because he's shown he doesn't take it seriously. But I could trust him on other halachos. So if I know that he doesn't keep kosher, right, to use that as an example, I can still trust him to say that, I don't know, that this business deal is honest, it's not theft, or whatever it is. The fact that he doesn't observe one halacha doesn't trace him up, so to speak, regarding another halacha. For we learn in Chulin, he gives you the page, that one who is a mumar for one matter is not considered a mumar for the entire Torah. Mumar being somebody who rebels against the Torah, rebels against the halacha. Other than, but here's the exception, one who is a mumar for idolatry or violating Shabbat in public, who is considered like a mumar for the entire Torah. He says, once you get to the issue of Shabbos, once you get to the issue of Avodah Zarah, idolatry, those are critical to the whole belief in God and the whole system, and therefore someone who doesn't believe in that, I can't believe him at all for any area of halacha. That's the Rashba based on the Gemara in Chulin. Well, that's part of the discussion. That's actually what comes up in Chulin. That's where this comes into play in the discussion. Chulin is what he can testify about and what he can't. That's the question. Right, so mumar we take to mean rebel. We usually take that to mean rebellion. An Am Ha'aretz seems to be somebody who is not necessarily learned or simply lax because, let's say, he looks around and no one else is doing it, that type of a thing. As opposed to a mumar, which we tend to believe is a more active choice. We have two different types of mumar. There's the mumar l'tayavon, meaning out of appetite. He wants to do X and he feels driven to do it, and therefore he says, I know it's wrong, but I'm going to do it anyway. And then there's the mumar lahachis, the person who does it, saying, yeah, I'm angry at God, or what, and you know, I'm doing this, I don't even have a taiva for it, I don't want to do it, but I'm going to do it anyway just to prove a point. So that's the worst. And actually, if you read further in the Rashba, I didn't quote it here, he goes into that point also about the mumar l'tayavon having greater credibility on other areas than the mumar lahachis. Because the mumar l'tayavon is just driven by a specific desire. The Rambam talks about this in the positive. That's the negative, right? This case that we just saw is the negative, the case of someone you can't trust. On the other hand, we have the concept of a chaver, someone you can trust and you can trust to an absurd degree. If a Talmud Chacham, when he uses the term Talmud Chacham here, it's odd actually. What we mean is a chaver, the person who has accepted upon himself that he is going to observe standards of kashrut, of tithing, of tumah and tahara. So if he passes on and leaves behind produce, they may be assumed to have been tithed. You can assume that Trum and Maaser were separated from the produce. Just because it was his produce, he never would have left it otherwise. Even if they were collected only that day. It's fresh off the vine, right? He has tomatoes fresh off the vine. And he died the same day. Nonetheless, I'm able to assume that Trum and Maaser were separated because a chaver is so careful that he would never, ever leave the stuff without being tithed. Not even for a couple of hours. He would take care of it immediately. So you have your two extremes. The one I cannot trust, because he has demonstrated that he doesn't follow community standards, and the one who I can trust, because he has committed to follow them to the nth degree. Now, there's nuance in this within halacha. this issue of not being able to trust people because they don't observe, and that leading to, potentially, a separation of association is not so clear-cut. Take a look at source number 9, please. A Mishnah in Shviz, it's also brought in Gittin. It talks about lending equipment to somebody who's going to use it to violate halacha. So he says, a woman may lend a sifter, sieve, mill, or oven to her friend who is suspected of violating the laws of Shemitah. But she may not sift or grind with her. Right? It's a Shemitah year. I know full well that my friend is violating the laws of Shemitah, going out farming, growing stuff, and now she's going to process it on this equipment. So I'm allowed to give her the equipment, even though I know that she's going to break the law with it. However, I can't actually engage in it. We draw a line. We try to keep an association to a certain extent. We don't want to alienate. But on the other hand, we don't want to commit the crime just to avoid alienating. All of this was said only for peaceful practices. In other words, the point is to keep the peace. And then he says, one may grasp the hands of non-Jews in Shemitah, but not the hands of Jews. Grasping the hands is an expression for encouragement, like saying Yasher Koach. So if I see a Jew out farming during Shemitah, I can't go up to him and say, oh, good job, or how's it going? I hope you get a good crop this year. I can say it to someone who isn't Jewish, but I can't say it to a Jew. One may ask after them, though, for peaceful practices. However, even though I see him out there farming during Shemitah, and I know what he's doing is wrong, and he knows what he's doing is against the halacha, I'm still allowed to say, how are the kids? I'm allowed to say, good morning, to the Jew who I see mowing his lawn when he's not supposed to be. That's still an acceptable thing. We're walking a line here between wanting to associate more with the people who honor the ideology of the community and who accept the practices of the community, but we don't want to alienate those who are not keeping to that. In fact, the Chachamim did, to a certain extent, subvert these standards in the name of special unity. We saw it in the food discussion, right, regarding Yom Tov. They subverted the standards in order to maintain unity. We also see it in the discussion about counting people for a minyan. Take a look at source 10. Look at what the Shulchan Aruch says regarding who counts for a minyan. He says, Avaryon sha'avar al gzeras hatzibur o sha'avar avera. You have a transgressor, a sinner who violated communal decrees, or who violated a prohibition, may be counted towards a minyan. We don't rule him out. Unless he has been excommunicated. We do have a line, but we draw the line pretty far over. Right? We try to make our group as broad as possible. So that's one area of halacha where this issue of trust comes into play, trying to include those who honor the communal standards, and trying to go a little broader as well where possible. Good so far? Okay. Second is the issue of Darkei Shalom, of trying to preserve peace, engaging in activities that build trust among Jews, and as we'll see, in general society as well. If you take a look on your sheets, if you want to flip the page, the Mishnah in Gittin, the first actually in a series of sources there. Eilu Devarim Amar B'nei Darkei Shalom, the following practices are for the sake of keeping the peace. Kohen Kore Rishon, first we call up a Kohen for the first Aliyah. V'achra of Levi, then we call up a Levi. V'achra of Yisrael, and then a Yisrael. Why? Mipnei Darkei Shalom, for peaceful practices. Meaning, if we were to simply say everybody's eligible for every Aliyah, then we would fall back on the idea that the greatest Tamar Chacham, the greatest dignitary in there, is the one who gets called up first. So the minute I call up somebody for the first Aliyah, somebody else is going to say, why are you calling him and not me? Why are you calling him and not my cousin, my brother-in-law, my brother, whatever it is? And it becomes a war. So you figure, all right, we'll give the Kohen the first Aliyah. That takes care of that. We'll give Levi the second Aliyah. That takes care of that. By the time you hit the third Aliyah, no one's going to fight over Shlishi. Right? Which just goes to show how well they understood human nature. In any case, theoretically, no one's going to fight over Shlishi. That's the idea at any rate. Similarly, Ma'arvin Bebayis Yashan. We set up the Erev meal in the house that's already established for the practice. Meaning, if you have a group of houses that open onto a yard, the rule is that I may not transport from the houses into the yard or from the yard into the houses on Shabbos unless we create an Eruv Chatzeros, a joint meal owned and accessible by everybody within the yard, and I have to put it in one of the residences. So he says, don't move it out of the house where it's been. If the practice has always been that the meal was in such and such a house, keep the meal in that house. Why? Darkei Shalom, for peaceful practices, because we don't want to create a situation where the person there is going to say, well, you don't trust me anymore. You don't like my house anymore. That's all we need. So rather than do that, we keep it in the same house. We try for peace wherever possible. If you take a look at source number 12, you find an example regarding Tisha B'Av. The halacha is that on Tisha B'Av, one is not supposed to greet somebody else normally. It's a day of mourning. So he says, chaverim, do not greet each other. But if Amei Haaretz greet, if the Amei Haaretz is going to say hello to you, then we respond with a soft tongue and with solemnity. Meaning, you don't not respond at all. You respond in a way that demonstrates, you know, today's a little different. But you do respond. Because we want to try to promote trust and good feeling within the community. This applies both to Jews and to non-Jews. But it's not carte blanche for everything. Go back to the source that we saw before in Shvius, right? It was source number 9, where we said, yes, you give the implements for her to use, but no, you don't go use them with her. So Darkei Shalom, this idea of trying to promote trust through peaceful practices, does have its limit. There does come a point where you say, sorry, this is something I can't do. This is an area I can't go into. So what we've seen then so far within this topic, and then we'll break till next week, is number one, the role of trust in building society in general, in terms of economics, in terms of the general function of society, and the way that religion and recognition of shared ritual can help a religion to build trust among its members. And the role of trust in building society in cases in Tanakh, where trust helped and where lack of trust destroyed. And then finally, we saw two areas within halacha where trust comes into play. One, in establishing communal standards and trying to honor those, and so create a community of trust around those standards. And then number two, in terms of promoting practices which will generate trust among people by avoiding strife and creating these shared opportunities. We still need to see two more areas of trust, and then develop the idea still further, God willing, next week.